and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is Jeffrey Dvorkin, Ombudsman at NPR. Concerns or criticisms about what you hear or don't hear on the radio? Let me know. I'll make sure they get to the right people and you get an answer. Here's how to reach me. Write 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20001. Phone 202-513-3246. Email ombudsman@npr.org. Thanks for keeping the public in National Public Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is hour number two of our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we have a story for you about a song. Now, this is a song that has become something of a classic of international pop folk, if that makes any sense. It's a song that I am fairly confident that almost everybody listening to us this morning will have heard. And the song that we're talking about is known by various names. One of the things that it's called is The Lion Sleeps Tonight. And maybe people, depending on their age, will remember a version from 1961. It was recorded by a doo-wop group called The Tokens, and apparently it was the only hit they ever had. It came back in another version, which did very well, in the 70s. You may also know it as a version of this song recorded by the Weavers. Pete Seeger picked the song up and liked it, and they did it and recorded it in the 50s. The interesting thing about this song is that its roots go back a long way further. It goes back to a Zulu choral group and its leader, a man named Solomon Linda, who recorded the song in 1939 in South Africa. And there was a very interesting and tangled story about who thinks they own this song and who has profited from it. And one of the sort of sad features of the story is, in fact, the man who created the song really got nothing out of it. And his heirs are still trying to see if they can get some of the proceeds, to which a lot of people feel that they are entitled. Our guest for this part of Focus 580 is Christopher Waterman. He's dean of the UCLA School of the Arts and Architecture. He's an anthropologist and, among other things, is interested in music and performing arts and the cultures of sub-Saharan Africa. He's also a musician himself. He's a professional bassist and has written about music in Africa in a book titled Juju, A Social History and Ethnography of an African Popular Music. He's also co-authored the book American Popular Music from Minstrelsy to MTV. And he is here on the U of I campus. He's visiting. His visit here is sponsored by the Global Studies Program at the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences and will be taking part in a couple of events, in fact, this afternoon, talking about this very business that we're talking about, giving a talk titled World Music's The Lion Sleeps Under Many Covers, in which he will talk about some of the various versions of this. He's going to talk in the Follinger Auditorium this afternoon, 4 o'clock, and I believe that anybody who's interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. He's also going to take part in a panel discussion looking at the place of the arts in the 21st Century Academy. That's tonight at 7:30 in the Humanities Lecture Hall of the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. And I think, again, there, anybody who feels like stopping in should feel welcome. As we talk, also questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
It is my pleasure.
This is a fascinating story about which I knew nothing. Certainly, I'm sure my first exposure to this music would have either been the 61 version, probably that would have been the first one that I had heard, or maybe it was that I heard the Weavers, and would have no idea about its history. So maybe, maybe as a way of starting, you could talk about Solomon Linda. Who was Solomon Linda?
Solomon Linda was a musician, a singer, but also a mine worker in the gold mines in South Africa, as many men like him, Zulu men, in the early 20th century were, as people got pulled into this new economy based on extracting minerals and so on that really built the backbone of the South African economy. He was a specialist in a style of music that I think a lot of your listeners may be familiar with from the performances of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, who have been on Lifesaver ads and Sesame Street and were on Paul Simon's Graceland album, the album that really directed a lot of the attention of a lot of people in this part of the world anyway toward this rich tradition in South Africa. Basically, teams of men in the mines, men taken away from their home communities as the African populations of South Africa were pushed onto not the best land in South Africa for farming and so on, as the workforce was reorganized in keeping with this this industry. Men who left home, they developed their own artistic traditions of storytelling and song and dance that reflected their own reality, as human beings will do. And so they tell these great heroic stories about placing dynamite charges in the face of the mine and the danger they face. There was also a lively prostitution trade, lively nightlife trade, and music went along with a lot of that. The song and dance teams, Ladysmith Black Mambazo being one example, as I mentioned, were actually supported by the government in some ways. It's an interesting, again, one of these complex kind of issues. On the one hand, they allowed self-expression for these men who did not, you know, who were sleeping 20 guys in a room in these workers' hostels under very harsh conditions and had to have work passes, a kind of passport within their own country, presumably, to move around. So a form of self-expression, specifically male working class Zulu, often sung in the Zulu language, expression, and you could argue maybe a kind of a form of rebellion, symbolic rebellion. And if you've ever seen Ladysmith Black Mambazo, you know that there's this very subtle dance tradition that goes along with it. In fact, the term for this style of performance now, isikatamia, actually is a reference to treading lightly or stepping lightly. So it's a way of expressing virility and strength and potency, but in this very beautifully styled, nuanced sort of way. From the point of view of the authorities, of course, this was a way to blow off steam. Mm. You know, it kept people from actually fighting or rebelling and so on. It's kind of like carnival in Brazil. You know, scholars argue back and forth. Is it a form of resistance or is it something that keeps people sort of tamped down? Anyway, Solomon Linda rose to prominence in his community and formed a group called the Evening Birds in the 1930s. He was born in 1909. And they toured around and began competing and started winning every cup. Sometimes you won money. Sometimes you'd win a traditional symbol of value like a goat or a cow and rose to prominence. And at this point, when the record company first came to record him, he'd already pretty much established a great reputation.
So he goes into – so he's well – they're already sort of local stars. He goes into this record company. And it was a record company that was owned by an Italian guy.
Actually, his dad, Eric Gallo, was an Italian immigrant, but his dad designed the sewer system in Pretoria, the capital of South Africa, and really wanted him to be an engineer and grow up like, you know, being a good, responsible guy. And he was kind of a gambler and a womanizer.
Sort of a playboy kind of.
So he started a record label, which is what playboys and people like that sometimes do.
So he had this record label, and I guess he started out by recording some, what was it, like American – the Zulu group singing American country songs?
Well, something country like music that was a big deal. In fact, Eric Gallo said he's now passed on, but lived to a ripe old age. And Gallo Records that he started in the 30s really was the South African record industry and still is the major, major label there for many, many years. He had an arrangement with Brunswick Records in England, who also make pool tables. You've probably seen tables. Yeah, yeah. Back then, they made the gramophones and the wooden cabinets and everything as well. And he says he survived the depression in South Africa, which, as in this country, but even more in South Africa, was very severe, by selling Bing Crosby records, because he was a Brunswick artist in England, but also country and Western songs, Jimmy Rogers and the Carter Family, all those 1920s and 30s recordings of what was derogatorily called hillbilly music in the record industry here, a lot of them to white South Africans, particularly Afrikaners, who, as in many cases, rural people and farmers and so on, found something to relate to, I think, in that music. Interestingly, today, Americans are often surprised to learn how very, very popular country music is in Africa, not just among people of European extraction, but among Africans as well. There's something in the music, I suppose, the stories they tell and so on, that has made it one of the most popular kinds of music in Africa.
So then Gallo also got this idea that there was this potential black audience and thought, well, okay, let's record some of these singing groups. And no doubt because Linda and the original Evening Birds were big stars, he figured, well, people will pay, black South Africans will pay money for these records.
And as is often the case, it was true, I think, in rhythm and blues here in the United States, there was a black entrepreneur, a recording fellow named Motsiola, who was Zulu himself and was middle class. This was before apartheid was imposed as a programmatic way of excluding and wiping out the black middle class in South Africa, after all. But he was an entrepreneur, and Gallo relied on him, and he did have connections into the community. So it is he who really brought Solomon Linda into the recording studio. And maybe it would be interesting. I mean, it is a revelation to hear this original 1939. Those of us brought up on the Tokens, it's a wonderful recording. It is a slick pop recording. Or even the Weavers, who for many people in our audience, I would think, certainly for me, are kind of icons of, sure, you know, Pete Seeger and a open-minded and, well, let's say liberal, at least, approach to things, folk music. It's kind of a revelation to hear this. The one thing I would ask the audience, we're going to play the whole track, which is about 3 minutes. And those familiar with old 78 RPM gramophone records know that's how much music you could fit on them. You couldn't go beyond 3 minutes, and that shaped all kinds of music all over the world. But what I want you to listen for, you'll hear the familiar boom, 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 Imbube. And by the way, what they're singing is not Wimowe. As we'll discover later, that was Pete Seeger's mishearing of a Zulu word, which is Imbube, which means lion. There are no words in this song. It's just an improvisation with the chorus repeating lion, lion, ha, lion over and over again. So you'll hear that very familiar structure. But for those of you that know this song as The Lion Sleeps Tonight, as in The Lion King, the Disney animated feature, do do dee do do dee do 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 do, that melody, see if you can hear where it comes in. And I think you'll be surprised at where that happens.
All right. So this is Solomon Linda and his original Evening Birds, South Africa, 1939. Right? All right, let's hear it. Now, what I have read about that is that keening falsetto line that we associate with the chorus of The Lion Sleeps Tonight, that Solomon Linda essentially made that up on the spot. It was sort of an improvisation. Is that right?
Well, we know that's true. I've heard there were three versions of this song, three alternate takes, as they call them, on this same day in Johannesburg in 1939. And he only sings the song that those of us who know the Tokens version or have heard it in The Lion King and so on know as In the Jungle, the Quiet Jungle. He only sings that. He's improvising and singing these beautiful overarching lines above in falsetto, but he only sings it on the 16th time through this structure that keeps repeating, and it's 12 notes, and it's a throwaway. He doesn't even finish it. He's dee, 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 and it kind of trails off. Yeah. And I've had actually students say, he didn't finish the song. Well, of course, the song didn't exist then, and we're going to talk about the process by which it came to exist.
And that's the way that we know it with that English lyric was not in the original. Somebody else wrote that for the Tokens because they thought it had to have an English lyric. And essentially, all the chanting part of the song is that, as you said, there's just sort of the guys are just sort of chanting lion. Hey. Hey, lion. That's all there.
Those are the lyrics. And just to let you know where this kind of choral texture comes from, because it's quite beautiful, and it has some features that are very typical of traditional Zulu singing, keeping in mind that the word traditional is provisional here, because Zulu singing was always changing and being affected by politics and changes in the culture and so on. But the way, if you listen to the singers, they slide up into the pitches, hey, hey, and the breathy sound, where you let a lot of air escape out of your throat, not the classic operatic sort of approach where you don't, are all a positive aesthetic thing in Zulu singing. So you hear that. The structure, this is an SATB for your folks who sing in church or in choirs, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, although these are all men singing, but a four-part harmony, definitely derived from church hymns at the time in South Africa. The Scots Presbyterian hymnody was particularly influential on Zulu singers. And finally, minstrelsy. And of course, Americans, I think rightly from our point of view, regard minstrelsy with either anger or embarrassment, depending on where we are, the white guys in blackface image of it. But African-American minstrel choirs, including Orpheus McAdoo, had toured South Africa in the late 19th century and had an incredible influence. And if you watch Ladysmith Black Mambazo, you can still see the influence of American minstrelsy, which from the point of view of impoverished Zulu workers was seen as this very hip, very progressive, black cosmopolitan form that had come from the U.S. So this whole performance is already shaped by a number of these existing, coexisting traditions all jostling with one another. And then here comes Solomon Linda with this gorgeous falsetto. And again, it's a gesture. The melody is just a gesture at the end. It's like a jazz musician improvising. It's a bit of a throwaway, and then the recording fades to black. And that's the end of that.
I have a caller, and I want to get to them because I've been waiting patiently. Just one other quick question here to round out this little bit. How much did Solomon Linda get for this?
10 shillings, which was not insubstantial augmentation of a Zulu mine worker's wages. On the other hand, no royalties. And, of course, this is a situation familiar to us from the American record industry and all over. That is, no continuing payments based on the playing of the record on radio or sales of the record at all. He had got a job in the record packing plant, which at least got him out of the mines for Gallo. That was about as far as it went for many, many years.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Christopher Waterman. He is Dean of the School of Arts and Architecture at UCLA and is interested in, among other things, in music, particularly African music, and will be giving a talk on the story that we're telling here, the story of this song and its many different versions. He'll be talking this afternoon at the Follinger Auditorium, 4 o'clock, and anybody who's interested, titled World Music's The Lion Sleeps Under Many Covers. And this is a song, as I said at the beginning, I'm sure a lot of people listening to us will know it, but depending upon their age, perhaps, they might know the Weavers version, they might know the Tokens version. There was also one that was a hit again in 1972, which I think, interestingly enough, was produced by one of the former Tokens. And
Robert John. One of the worst songs of my senior year in high school, in my opinion, right. But that's just me.
And of course, many, many other performers have recorded the song. Lots and lots of versions have recorded the song. We have a caller here, someone in her band, and we'll talk with them. Line one.
Yeah, hi. I love that song. I come from New York and was in New York in the 50s when Pete Seeger introduced it. I think it was in Town Hall, and it electrified. I'm pretty certain he said at the beginning, here's a new song I learned, and was even before the Weavers. And he divided up the audience Am I right about that? Was it in Town Hall when he introduced that?
I think that would have been one of the early instances, and I will. I can talk a little bit about the, yes. The Weavers led a bit of a double life as a folk group, but also for a while until The Blacklist, which you know about,
yeah.
And McCarthy and
yeah.
So on, as a pop group for Decca Records, and those recordings are rather different than the kinds of things he did as a folk musician.
Well, he stood up there, and I can remember where he stood on the stage, and he had his banjo, and when he sang in that high-pitched falsetto, it really electrifying is the word, and he divided up the audience so that they could join in the, I forgot how it goes.
They gave him the different parts and
repetitions, and he divided up, and it was such a marvelous experience. I was also lucky because I lived in the village on 11th Street, and Freddie Hellerman lived next door, and every so often I'd hear the Weavers rehearse from my bedroom window, and I would sit there and listen.
You are a blessed person. What a wonderful experience to
have. It was, and I mean, we were very, very involved, and we really went to all, concerts with Lee Hayes and Freddie Hellman and everybody else.
Oh, that's terrific. That really was. It was a time, as I think the movie about the Weavers is entitled.
I mean, and it was so refreshing. Also, is Miriam Makeba, is she one of the, is her background Zulu music?
She is Xhosa, actually, a different ethnic group in South Africa, but she recorded it, and we may get to it in the show if we get there. I've got, in this lecture I'm giving, I'm going to play about 10 different versions, everything including a German punk band called Lederknochen, musicians in other parts of Africa. One of the things about the song, and you brought it up, is that it's participatory. It seems to invite participation. I think because a lot of people, at least who grew up within the gravitational force field of the Christian choral tradition, the hymn tradition, and you don't have to be Christian to have heard this kind of music and grown up, it has easy parts to sing. You know what I mean? It's got pretty clear a top part that you can improvise, which is what Pete was doing and what Solomon did. And then these middle parts, imbube, and then the big bass part down on the bottom.
Right. But I'm thinking of like a song like Pata Pata, which we dance to, that Miriam Makeba, we have a recording in a group I dance with.
Yes.
Would that be that tradition?
Absolutely.
It's pop. I mean, it's fantastic. I always
sing
along and
yeah, it was terrific. And the click song was another one of her hits where she used the click sounds that are part of the phonology of Xhosa.
Yeah, that's right. Like the tribe, what was the name of the gods must be crazy?
That's right. They used it. That was used in there as well.
That was the same thing with the exclamation point.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Right. Well, it's very exciting. I mean, I suppose after you hear it many, many, many times, it's really degraded at times.
Well, the approach I'm taking, at least in the talk that I'm giving today, I've been working on this for about 20 years. I mean, the first time I did a panel at the Folklife Festival in Seattle 20 years ago, where we looked at about 6 versions of the song. And now I've collected between 200 and 300 versions.
Right.
It appears on children's records with multicultural and zoological themes. It fits into the Discovery Channel National Geographic image of Africa, which often leaves out the people and mostly focuses on the animals. Not to put that down. That's great.
Yeah,
it's better than not knowing anything about Africa. But it has been picked up by rock bands and by choirs. Of course, choirs love it because it's a great a cappella piece without instrumental accompaniment.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask you, what kind of instrument is he singing without any backup?
As it turned out, Griffith Motswela, who was the Zulu producer who was in the studio that day in 1939, and who actually, he was a middle-class guy, but he knew what was going on in the Zulu community, and he's the one that got Solomon Linda to come into the studio, ran out on the third take. They did 3 takes that day and got a piano player and a banjo player to play, but they were kind of out in the hallway, which is why it sounds distant.
Well, yeah, and I couldn't figure it out as you played it.
But it is astonishing. I found it a revelation the first time I heard this.
Yeah, it's this evolution of a song. It's like, even like, This Land Is My Land. It was ignored and ignored and ignored. Now it's become an anthem.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. It's not exactly like that, but I think it's very exciting, and I think I'm glad you did the research.
Mm-hmm. Why, thank you very much, ma'am.
Thank you for the call.
All right.
Well, let's continue telling the story. We talked about how the song was recorded by the Zulu group, Solomon Linda, and his original Evening Birds, 1939. And apparently it was a big hit among urban Zulus. It sold, I guess, a couple of hundred thousand copies of the record. It just there in South Africa.
It established the idea that black South Africans were a market to which the record industry might pay attention. Is basically what it did.
So, and we've also talked about the fact that for this caller, for example, a lot of other people, their version of the one that the way they were introduced to the song was by Pete Seeger and the Weavers, and they recorded it in 1952. So how did this record that was made in South Africa in 1939 end up in the hands of Pete Seeger in the early 50s and become a song that he apparently heard it and thought, hey, that's a good song. I can do that song.
I could do that one. It's an interesting story. Eric Gallo, again, who started Gallo Records, who we were talking about before, the son of the Italian immigrant, had a fellow working out in the field for him once they discovered that African groups, Zulu, Xhosa, Sotho, all of the different ethnic groups in South Africa, might actually sell records for them. And Hugh Tracy, who any ethnomusicologist listening, that's my field, ethnomusicology, will recognize as a quite famous Africanist ethnomusicologist and who knew Solomon Linda as well, sent a bunch of these records that had been released, including Imbube, to Decca Records. And this is no accident. This is sort of about global capitalism and transnationalism. The reason he sent them to Decca is because Decca was connected to Brunswick. And you remember I had mentioned the Brunswick company being connected with Gallo. So there's a reason it went to that company. Another character who may be familiar to some of your listeners, Alan Lomax, happened to be working at Decca Records at that point on a part-time basis. And he heard these recordings and thought, Pete Seeger's the man for these. Maybe there's something he can do with them, because he knew of Pete's interest in, so-called non-Western music. And actually, you could argue that Pete Seeger and his group, the Weavers, who had come out of some of them out of the Almanac Singers, Woody Guthrie's earlier group, were some of the first world beat artists in a sense, in that they reached out to Israeli folk songs and Australian folk songs and American folk music, but also African. Pete, who I've talked to about this, says he got the records and he listened to the stack of 78s. And the one that he heard that really caught his ear, for reasons we were just talking about, perhaps because of the simple but durable, clear structure of it that just kind of makes you want to sing along, was Imbube. He heard the lyric as Wimawe. He knew it had something to do with lions, but he didn't know isiZulu, the Zulu language, and so it kind of transmuted itself into Wimawe from Imbube. The other thing he said is he could tell it didn't have a lot of words, and he didn't want to mangle somebody else's language, which I think is a fairly noble
honorable approach.
Yeah,
exactly.
At this point, the Weavers are actually starting to become pop stars. This is the very beginning of what led to the Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and you could argue Bob Dylan, who's his own animal, of course, as we've seen in the recent documentary, but this, the Greenwich Village folk scene and touring colleges, as many rock bands do today, alternative rock bands and so on. They were the alternative music of the time. They were performing in the Village and were heard by a fellow named Gordon Jenkins, who came out of a very different background. He was an arranger for Frank Sinatra. He wrote arrangements for Bing Crosby as well. And it's Gordon Jenkins who, working with Pete Seeger and the Weavers, came up with the recording we're going to listen to next, which is the big 1952 number one hit for Decca Records. I will tell you ahead of time, many people who love the Weavers and think of them mainly as good old bearded Pete Seeger with suspenders, checkered shirt, and banjos and guitars, perhaps around a campfire, singing out of tune just a little, not really, but enough that you don't feel you're listening to virtuosos. You can jump in and sing with them, too. That was the whole point of this music. Come on, everybody. It's a community. This recording surprises a lot of people. And the one thing I would ask your listeners to listen for, there's a lot to hear here, is remember the melody. Dee, 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 dee. At the very end of Solomon Linda's thing, listen to where they put the melody when they did their version of his song, what they did with that melody.
All right. This is the Weavers. Let's hear it. And this is cut 3 on that disc? Yeah. Okay. Here we go. That I have never heard that. That is totally wild. So this was the Weavers. It was a big hit.
This was a big hit. This went actually to number 11, I think. It didn't go to number one, but it followed Goodnight Irene, which was their first. Remember, On Top of Old Smokey. People are sometimes shocked, especially if I may say, people a little bit like myself, lefty, folky, you know, the folk scare, as they used to call it during the 50s and so on, to hear this kind of slick pop production. But on the other hand, you know, when Pete heard the recording, when Alan Lomax called him, he was living in a walk-up cold water flat in the village and had kids and family and so on and wasn't making much money. And this was a way to make a living doing this while continuing his political activity. Mm-hmm. It wasn't long, I should say, after this that he was first named in front of the McCarthy hearings as a member of the Communist Party. And Decca pretty much dropped the Weavers like a hot potato, even though they were one of their hottest groups.
So he's come along and he's elaborated a little bit more on that.
Well, it's fascinating with luxury of listening to it a couple of times. But one thing is that, first, it starts out with this big band. It has little references to Count Basie, the little piano solo that is absolutely a cop of a Basie thing. It's interesting, too. Imagine being Gordon Jenkins, who really wrote this arrangement and I think is responsible for, Pete and the Weavers. Pete basically does a Solomon Linda thing. He improvises with a falsetto, and one can talk back and forth about which version you prefer, but the point is he's trying to actually capture the flavor of the original. Mm-hmm. Gordon is thinking, I imagine Gordon thinking, where's the hook? We need to make a pop record. And, it's kind of like mass production in capitalism when you're making cars. There are different parts to cars, and you have to assemble them, and then you have to make little stylistic changes, as with tennis shoes and other things that make people think they're buying something new or something cool, you know. And in pop music, it's often the same way. Well, the hook became, Jenkins, having a great ear, heard that little improvisation at the end of Solomon Linda's thing, moved it up to almost the beginning. There's a big band introduction, and then the strings come in, and it's the first time you hear this, it's being held up to your attention, bathed in this soft light of the orchestra, sort of, you know, dee, 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 and suddenly it becomes the song. Now, you notice, still in this version, the words are not there.
Yeah,
the
there's no reference. There's no line, there's no jungle, there's nothing like that.
And the other weird thing about this, frankly, is you've got the big band, so I can know we're sitting in Vegas or someplace or in a Hollywood sound studio, and then the next minute we're around a campfire in the woods and the band's gone away and you just have banjos, and then I think the band was hiding behind the trees because they come out again at the end.
So at this point we still don't have the lion in the jungle.
Right.
Maybe, I don't know if we're jumping too far ahead, but maybe, in the interest of time,
sure.
Let's go up to the Tokens. They apparently had learned the song by listening to the Weavers and sort of sang it, and were signed up by their record company, and they said to the record company, well, we got this song, we kind of like it, and we've been doing it. And the guys at the record company said, well, we don't know. It doesn't have any lyric. What's this song about? And then they brought in a guy to punch up the song a little bit, and then we have another version. That's when the Lion in the Jungle arrived.
Absolutely. Well, the Tokens were a nice quartet of Jewish boys in high school, at Lincoln High School in New Jersey. They went to high school with Neil Sedaka, so they were he was in their doo-wop group at first, if anybody knows that era of Brill Building 1960s pop. And they were busy reinventing themselves. They started out as kind of a hot rod, imitating the Italian-American doo-wop group, singing about cars and girls. And they couldn't really sing about the beach as much, I guess, as the Beach Boys, but, that vibe. And then out of desperation, they reinvented themselves more as a folk group once this folk thing took off and became profitable. And so they were working with producers who are known in the industry as Hugo and Luigi. People may not have heard of them, but they produced a lot of records, and rock critics hate them. I remember in the Rock of Ages, which is the Rolling Stone Guide to Rock Music, somebody says, one of the reviewers says that they managed to make the only bad Sam Cooke record ever just by killing it. And people talk about the dead hand of Hugo and Luigi on the mixing board in the studio. They're thought to be crass and schlocky. They also claimed to have written Waltzing Matilda, from Australia, a folk song, Greensleeves, which goes back to Shakespeare's time as an English ballad. And eventually they claim to have written Weemaway when they renamed it The Lion Sleeps Tonight. So a case of larceny, one could argue, or probably not homage, probably closer to larceny. They also, Hugo Creatore and Luigi Peretti, hired George Weiss, who'd been a Broadway songwriter and had worked with Sammy Davis Jr. in his first Broadway show and written a bunch of popular Tin Pan Alley songs, and said, "Hey, George, do something with this." And so George took it home, and he listened to the Weavers version. I don't think he'd ever heard the Solomon Linda. At this point, nobody knew about Solomon Linda because he'd not been credited on the Weavers recording, another story. But and so they tried to make this into a real pop tune. And why don't we listen to it right now and see if it stirs any memories.
All right. Here we go.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. In the jungle, the quiet jungle, the lion sleeps tonight. Near the village, the peaceful village, the lion sleeps tonight. Near the village, the quiet village, the lion sleeps tonight.
That is The Tokens, 1961. Maybe real quick, I want to introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580, Christopher Waterman. He's dean of the School of the Arts and Architecture at UCLA and is here visiting the campus to talk about this, one of his particular interests. That is the story of the song. And then, of course, more broadly, he's interested in African music. He's an ethnomusicologist and got his PhD here at the U of I. I didn't mention that.
I certainly did, in anthropology, 8 million years ago. No, not really.
So here now, yet we have another generation, another development of the song, and there's a whole another really complicated part of the story, which we probably don't have time to get into, about competing claims of ownership and who the song belongs to, because the guys who published for the Weavers, when they heard this song, they said, "Hey, hold on a song. That's our song."
Right.
And everybody, you know, there are a number of different people who are claiming, "No, that's ours, that's ours, that's ours."
And by the time you get to The Lion King, by the way, a lot of this has been in the courts recently, and there have actually been some amazing developments. But if you look at the credits on The Lion King, when you see a lot of people credited with a song, you usually know there's like a lawsuit behind it, and a whole bunch of people end up on that list.
So we're one of the things you talk about, the fact is that you've been working on this for a long time and you're going to give this talk, and you have a number of versions, and there are, I have read different figures. I've read 80. I have read 160. I don't know how many versions of the recorded versions of this there are. Where would you like to go next in our last 7-8 minutes?
Why don't we hear from the Nylons, who are an out gay a cappella men's group from Canada, started in Toronto, and they do a version of it which actually takes us into the jungle. Starts out,
Okay, so this will be good.
And, and
we're flashing signals to Henry.
A cappella groups, of course, love this song for reasons we've talked about. It's got a simple, durable structure, and it's a great vehicle for improvisation if you have a virtuoso soprano singer. Before we play this, though, I should mention the very, if anybody wants to know, on the Tokens cut, mm-hmm. which I think is how everybody, many people heard it first this way, right. That very high voice is Anita Darian. They actually hired an opera singer from New York to come over to New Jersey and record this and sing that very high soprano.
She was a token.
That's right. Oh!
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, The Nylons, 1982.
So those are the Nylons.
Those are the Nylons, and I'll give you the brief thing. I kind of expand on this a little bit when as time allows. But the Nylons are a group that performs both at general festivals with a straight and gay audience, and sometimes it's specifically lesbian and gay festivals. And a couple of friends of mine who have seen them in the latter context tell me that at least early on when they did it, this is a group with three white guys and a black guy in it, a West Indian fellow, that the way they would do it, quite different from the other festivals, was the three of the guys would be standing kind of like street toughs, like doing their nails with a knife, you know, kind of leather jackets, jeans, and so on. And the black member of the group would walk across the stage, tight jeans, black leather jacket, gorgeous. And these guys would start making animal noises at him, growling, and then gradually they would shift. And of course, this is a reference to what Spike Lee called jungle fever in the straight realm, which is that the jungle is a metaphor for interracial sex and attraction and romance. Mm-hmm. And so one of the points I try to make in my lecture is each different group takes this song and its symbolisms and turns it to purposes that make sense for them in their own situation, including Lederknochen, who we're going to hear from now, a German, I don't know how to describe it, punk group. The leader was born in Southwest Africa in Namibia, but they do their kind of freaked out German punk version of it in 1989, Lederknochen.
Yeah.
Lederknocken?
Lederknocken, a.k.a. Leathernecks. I guess it's a reference to U.S. Marines. They're called Lederknocken, the guy stationed in Berlin. But it's a punk group. And this fella has, some of his albums, the covers of them are masks that you can cut out, African masks, and you can dance to this music with the mask. What this is about in precise terms, it's hard to say, but certainly the notion of otherness, of primitivity, of excess, and all these things I'll be talking about in my lecture that attaches itself to Africa in general and to African music in people's minds around the world are clearly being played with here in some sense. I wanted just as our last last example to play something by Mori Kante, who is a Bambara musician from West Africa, from French West Africa, who also records in Paris. And he's part of this whole set of musicians that move from the formerly French-speaking, well, still French-speaking parts of Africa to Paris to make their recordings. He did a version of this working with South African musicians. And in a way, it's an example of pan-African or within Africa interactions and discussions that go on among musicians there. So this is Mori Kante's version from the mid-1990s.
Okay.
Mube, imbube, 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 mube, imbube, imbube.
I'm sorry, we can't play more, but we're kind of getting down to the end.
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about this.
Well, Mori Kante, who is a griot, I guess is the word that's most commonly used, particularly outside of Africa, a praise singer. And he plays the kora, which is a stringed instrument that's found in instruments like it in that part of West Africa up beneath the Sahara Desert. And these guys were the historians of kingdoms, ancient African kingdoms, and they're the ones regarded, they're called libraries sometimes. They remember all the history. Well, he, in the middle of this imbube thing, inserts a very old historical song in his language, in Bamana, and sings it in this context. So one could look at this as a great example of Pan-Africanism, of musicians in different parts of the continent interacting. But the one side to this is that he didn't give credit to Solomon Linda either. He claimed that it was, quote, traditional, which has all along been the gambit. If you can find a folk song, it's like finding unclaimed farmland or wild horses. And if you can tame them, you get to claim them as your own, basically. And so he participated in that, too. So I guess I would just say that it's never simple. It's always complex. Mm-hmm.
And is there still some effort going on in the part of the heirs of Solomon Linda to get some money?
Yes. Well, the folks who are the publishing company connected with the Weavers, Richmond/TRO, have actually just this year said that they're going to give all residuals, all royalties to the Linda family, his four daughters, who are still relatively impoverished in South Africa. Disney is in a major lawsuit, and a judge in South Africa has attached the images of Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse and said that until they work this out, all profits from the use of Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse in South Africa are potentially going to go to the Linda family. So that one's kind of frozen at the moment. Yeah. So it's a complex and still evolving story.
What a great story. I really appreciate you being here and sharing it with us. And my apologies to the caller who's been very patient. I'm very, very sorry that we couldn't get you in. Thanks for hanging in there. In any case, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more of the story, our guest for the program, Christopher Waterman, will be talking on this topic, World Music's The Lion Sleeps Under Many Covers, this afternoon at 4 in the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus. His visit here sponsored by the Global Studies Program at the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And they do have a website, by the way, if you want to take a look at it and see what they're up to. That's globalstudies.las.uiuc.edu. Christopher Waterman is Dean of the School of Arts and Architecture, UCLA. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The program made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible with funds from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Tastings held every Friday from 6 to 8, Saturday 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the term jihad. Does it mean a personal struggle within oneself or violent struggle in the name of Islam? We'll talk with a professor of religious studies at Rice University. His name is David Cook. He's the author of Understanding Jihad. He will join us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. It's 2 minutes before noon. Let's turn our attention to the Chicago Board of Trade, where December wheat is trading at 344, down 3 1/4. March, 357 1/4, down 4 1/4. December corn, 204 3/4, down 1. March, 217 3/4, down 3/4. May, 225 3/4, down 1/2. December, 248 3/4, down 1/4. November soybeans, 565 1/4, that up 2 3/4. January, 576 1/2, up 2 1/4. March, 585, up 2 3/4. October meal, 162.70, that down $1. October oil, 24.15, that up 35. October feeder.